Hey guys, it's Stephanie. This is episode 2 of The Love Activist, which I am calling Ubuntu. Before we dive right in, I want to read you something from an author named John Pavlovitz. If you don't follow him yet on every platform, I highly recommend it. He is all over social media. He has a blog. He writes often. He calls himself the pastor of the resistance. And so I'm just going to read you a little excerpt from one of his posts, but I'm just going to encourage you to really go read basically everything he has written. This is from a post he has that is titled "A Message to the Heartbroken." And he says this: "You're so exhausted by the feeling and the breaking and the bleeding, and you're asking yourself if you should just stop giving a damn. You shouldn't. Empathy is the lifeblood of our fragile humanity, dear friend. It is the thing that sustains us all. And in moments like this, it is more precious than ever. The world needs people like you who are willing to have their hearts broken. People who wake every day prepared to be wounded on behalf of another because they know that this wounding allows someone to be seen and heard and known when they most need to be. It is in inviting ourselves to feel the pain of each other that we see our kinship with them, our connectedness, our sameness. It is in the crucible of such bruising that the best parts of ourselves is formed. And the thing is, we've seen the price of becoming heartless. We know what happens when a human being loses the ability to grieve for another's suffering, when it disregards everything but itself. We've seen what such a life yields, and this is not the path worth walking, pain or no pain. You know that, and I know it. No, you and I are doomed to live this way because that fragile flexing muscle in the center of our chest will not let us live any other way. And yes, this heart is a weakness, but make no mistake, it is a weapon too. It is the thing that lifts us and moves us and propels us straight into the bloody battle when every instinct says to run the other way. It is the defiant, relentless, rebellious force that will not allow us to turn away when someone is hurting." So if you followed me when I was podcasting for Jesus and Yoga, you have already heard the term Ubuntu, and you have heard me talk often about this book called The Book of Awakening by Mark Nepo. They're daily readings, and this man has lived so much in life that he has so much to offer. And so I highly recommend that book for anyone who is looking. But I'm going to read to you from pages 239 and 240. And he says this: "Ubuntu, I am because you are because I am, which is a deep African way of being. In the winter, I met a man in South Africa. After several days together, I asked him about Ubuntu. He said it is a deep African custom. He did not explain, but rather repeated its meaning more slowly and with deeper reverence. It means, I am because you are because I am, Ubuntu. It is something I have always believed in, that in the ignited space of our deepest suffering, in the release of our deepest fears, in the familiar peace of our deepest joys, we are each other. I felt it in the cancer rooms, in the eyes of burdened mothers sitting across from me, none of us wanting the dark things growing inside. Ubuntu, I am because you are, even in how we live off the breath of plants. You are because I am, even in how plants live off of our exhalations. I remember years after Robert helped me survive cancer, after I helped him survive alcohol, I remember the two of us in a small park eating sandwiches with numb fingers like little damaged birds, and Robert raised his head suddenly and said, I have had cancer. And I took his hand and offered in return, and I have been an alcoholic. Ubuntu, how we need each other to be complete." So today I want to talk about this idea of Ubuntu and of compassion and of the work of really living out the idea that there are no others. And I think that I think that Richard Rohr really defines this really core truth for us in a really powerful way when he talks about non-dualism versus dualism. So to live dualistically would be to live with the mindset and the idea and the energy and whatever you're putting forth, this message that says it's me versus you, it's us versus them, it's winning or losing. There are two sides. There's, you know, this like constant abrasive competition between people, or like a constant war between people. Living non-dualistically would be to say there are no others. It would be to say Ubuntu, I am because you are because I am. Now, that does not mean that there's an absence of conflict. In fact, I've heard Richard Rohr say that living non-dualistically is the ideal, but sometimes when we're in situations that are dependent, like we're talking about human rights, or we're talking about equality, or we're talking about oppression, in those situations, you would need to lean more towards the idea of like a certainty, a black and white rather than a gray area. But even in that, it is possible to still be non-dualistic. It is possible to still view people as an extension of your own self, to be able to say to someone on an opposing side, Ubuntu, I am because you are because I am. So this is not something that we're really given a manual for. There's no tool bag for this. And so we tend to get really confused, and especially right now in a very heated time in our country, when we are looking at issues of human rights, we are looking at oppression, we are face to face with racism and with sexism and with bigotry. We are face to face with phobias that would cause people to say there's an us versus them. And so in order to pursue a lifestyle of Ubuntu, of compassion, of non-dualism, we are going to have to continue to stand in the face of those things and sometimes say hard things. But if at the heart of it, we are cultivating a life of Ubuntu, we are doing the good work. I heard Glennon Doyle Mountain say on a live feed a few weeks ago, she said, what do you say to the friends and the people who are saying, why are you suddenly all about politics? Why aren't you about people? And she said the best line. She said, politics is people. We are talking about the policies that affect human lives. We are talking about the things that completely transform the quality of someone's life, their own safety, or their right to live, even. So when we're resisting hatred, when we're resisting racism, when we're resisting sexism, when we're resisting policies that would take away basic human rights, then we are talking about people. We're not just talking about politics. And the way I kind of see this is, I heard Rob Bell once say, that the reason why we love Jesus is because Jesus took theology, the word, and made it flesh. And the reason why we bristle against theology is because people take the flesh and they make it word again. So I see that in this sense too. We sometimes get a little tangled up because some people are out there just looking for an argument. They just want to be right. They're seeking a life of politics for the sake of an argument. But friends, Pharisees did that, right? Like, just let's argue this point and that point, but we're not actually talking about humanity here. What we're seeing happen is that just everyday normal American people, and to be fair, people worldwide, are kind of putting their hand in the air and saying, oh, wait, no. I have something to lend to that conversation, and it's about people. It's about humanity. It's about rights and safety and care for actual human beings. And so we run this risk of, when we talk about politics, of butting up against someone who is not talking about people, but is talking about things that might make them sound right. And you'll notice that you're in that conversation because everything is kind of spiraling. It's never landing anywhere. And even if there's a really good point brought to the table, that other person who's just fighting for the politics of it and not the people, not the humanity, not the actual lived experience, the living, breathing people, they're going to skirt around that comment or that post or that thing that is spoken to them. And they're just going to find a way to keep arguing another point. You'll notice this. Chidima, I was just on my girlfriend Chidima's podcast. She's really great. It's the Type A Hippie Chi Cast. If you want to go find her, I definitely recommend it. And we were talking about what we run into on Facebook and how like, will post an article about something, and then people will come in for the fight, and they will have not read the article, and so they want to make it about something else. And Chidima's gotten really good at redirecting it, saying, oh, no, we're not talking about that right now. We're talking about this. And so there's a way to kind of experience this, this personalizing of politics, if we can stay on topic, if we can keep ourselves paying attention to the real conversation that's happening about human lives and not get caught up in the argument, in the fight that's going nowhere. Because there are people out there who are going to bait you. They're looking to do that exact thing. They're looking to cause confusion. They're looking to manipulate the situation. They're looking to get a rise out of you so they can point a finger and say what you've probably have all heard, whether you're liberal or not, but you're fighting for human rights. You're going to hear them say, typical liberal, there you are shutting down the conversation because you don't like what you're hearing. Now, there's a difference between not liking someone's opinion and their and being abused by someone verbally. And I think it's really fair to draw the line wherever you are and to only engage in conversations that you know are going somewhere. Do not exert your energy somewhere where it is wasted. So I think it's super important in cultivating this like underlying foundation of Ubuntu in our lives to decide, number one, that politics is people. We are talking about people. We're not just talking about theology. We're not just talking about ideology. We are talking about actual human beings and their lives and what we can do to protect them and defend them and to better the lives that they're living. How can we stand arm in arm with a great sense of I am because you are and you are because I am? We are living off of each other's inhale and exhale. We are that connected. As Mother Teresa said, if we have no peace, it's because we've forgotten that we belong to one another. So it's important for us to remember that politics is people. It's also important for us to commit ourselves to this practice of Ubuntu, which means that we are not seeking a life of politics for the sake of an argument. We are not choosing to be those hypocritical religious leaders or hypocritical political leaders that we see throughout history who are just there to argue and to make themselves sound bigger and better than they are. We are not here to take the flesh and make it word again. We are here to contribute to taking the word and making it flesh. We want to put hands and feet and voices and arms and love to theology in a sense. We want to take scripture and stories and people's lived experiences and we want to make them more and more real. We want to put them out into the world in a way that produces more of this lifestyle of compassion and of non-dualism. So I have this story that I want to share with you. And it's a story that is found in a letter that a man named Paul wrote to his friends in a town called Galatia. And so in the New Testament, it's in a book called Galatians. And just a little backstory here on kind of what's happening culturally. First of all, the Jewish tradition is that a rabbi would choose the most educated of boys, the most intelligent of boys, like the ones that they felt like were really smart and were going to really get it. And then they would raise them as essentially a disciple or an apprentice. And that boy would be educated by the rabbi, would grow up under the rabbi until he was old enough and able to begin his own teaching his own way, his own perception of scripture. Jesus did not do this. This is not the Jesus way. Jesus instead chose boys who had been overlooked. He chose boys who had grown up to be fishermen, who were hotheads. In fact, two of his friends, James and John, were referred to as the sons of thunder because they were that hot-headed. So Jesus, in the raising up of his way, of this new thing, which is total like spiritual and political upheaval, because he's essentially saying the way you've been doing it all along no longer applies. There's something new in the mix here. And for those of you who have gone through the process of spiritual or worldview deconstruction, you know exactly what's happening here. This is the ultimate deconstruction of faith. And so Jesus chooses these men to be his followers, his disciples, as he is their teacher, and they follow him. Now, a little later on, after Jesus has already died, a man named Saul comes onto the scene. Now, Saul was chosen as a child to be a disciple of a rabbi. He is educated. He knows pretty much everything there is to know about scripture. He has been raised up to do this as a job. He has status. He has power. He has influence. He probably has money. He has the backing of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So the spiritual authority in this time period. Now, Saul hates that people are doing this to the faith that he intellectually knows so well. And so he views it as heresy and as a problem, and he actually gets the permission of the religious leaders of the time to round up these new followers of the way and to stone them to death. At some point, Saul is on a road to a town called Damascus, and he has, if you listened to last week's podcast, what I would call a trans-rational encounter with the mysterious God of the universe. And everything flips upside down for Saul. And he renames himself Paul, which means little and small. And then he spends years, I think it was 3 years, with a man named Barnabas, educating himself, learning, finding out more, allowing humility to kind of take over his life. He throws himself then into this new way, this way of Jesus, and he goes looking for answers. Is this the way? What does this look like? Like, maybe even how do I live in amends towards the people I've wronged already? And at some point, now in Galatians 2, Paul and his friend Barnabas and their friend Titus, they go to Jerusalem. And now Paul and Barnabas have been living outside of the Jewish community. They've been living in these, what they would call, Gentile cities. So the people that Paul has been bringing this new message of this new way of life to, these people do not have a Jewish heritage. So he's actually not teaching people that he had been teaching his whole life. Now, Jesus' friends, his disciples, Peter included, they're still in Jerusalem. They are teaching this way to people with a Jewish heritage. So essentially, they're giving the same message, but in very different ways. And so Paul and Barnabas and Titus come to Jerusalem. And they have this like meeting and a conversation with the disciples. And they basically decide that it's good that Paul and Barnabas are loving and caring for and speaking this message to people without Jewish tradition. And it's good that Peter and James and John are giving this message to people with a Jewish tradition. And so they kind of see that these are like two hands of the same body. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. I'm going to read it to you. This is Paul's letter to his friends. And so I want to point out to you before I even read it that not only does Paul do this thing, but he writes it in a letter. So there's a lot of exposure happening here for Peter. It says this: "As for those who are considered important in the church, their reputation does not concern me. God isn't impressed with mere appearances, and neither am I. And of course, these leaders were able to add nothing to the message I had been preaching. It was soon evident that God had entrusted me with the same message to the non-Jews as Peter had been preaching to the Jews. Recognizing that my calling had been given by God, James, Peter, and John, the pillars of the church, shook hands with me and Barnabas, assigning us to a ministry to the non-Jews, while they continued to be responsible for reaching out to the Jews. The only additional thing they asked was that we remember the poor, and I was already eager to do that. Later, when Peter came to Antioch, which is a town that is not within the Jewish culture, I had a face-to-face confrontation with him because he was clearly out of line. Here's the situation. Earlier, before certain persons had come from James, Peter regularly ate with the non-Jews. But when that conservative group came from Jerusalem, he cautiously pulled back and put as much distance as he could manage between himself and his non-Jewish friends. That's how fearful he was of the conservative Jewish clique that's been pushing the old system. Unfortunately, the rest of the Jews in the Antioch church joined in that hypocrisy so that even Barnabas was swept along in the charade. But when I saw that they were not maintaining a steady, straight course according to the message, I spoke up to Peter in front of them all. If you, a Jew, live like a non-Jew when you're not being observed by the watchdogs from Jerusalem, what right do you have to require non-Jews to conform to Jewish customs just to make a favorable impression to your old Jerusalem cronies? All right, guys, let me be clear about this. Paul, who does not have the status that Peter has, recognizes that Peter is acting hypocritically, that he is, up until now, he'd been crossing these racial barriers. He had been eating with people that the Jewish customs would declare unclean. He had been entering in a new system and kind of putting away the old system. And all of a sudden, when people come to observe Peter, Peter reverts back to old behavior. Now, Paul does not quietly pull Peter aside to call him out on it. He does not just stay quiet and think, well, he knows better than I know. No, in front of everyone, Paul confronts Peter. He gets in his face and he says hard things. There are a few things about this for me. One is that it was important for those people who had been brought in to this new way of essentially Ubuntu, this way that says there are no others, there's no dualism here, there is us, not a you and a me, but an us. We exist here together, we are for each other, everyone is equal, we belong to one another. Those people clearly noticed when Peter suddenly reverted to an old way and they were on the outs. And that had to sting. So not only did Paul want to confront Peter, but he did it in a way that ensured that those people who had just been wounded by Peter's behavior heard the voice of an advocate and an ally standing up for them. Not only did he need to call it out, he needed to call it out in a way that made it very clear that this behavior doesn't fit here. We do not live this way. This is not who we are here. He was setting a precedent, and it didn't matter that he was not one of the original disciples. Paul had walked his own road long enough to know that only love could live here, that only Ubuntu belonged here. And I have heard it said over and over again in the last few months that people who love Jesus, followers of the Jesus way, should not be publicly calling out hatred and racism and bigotry and sexism and ableism. The list goes on. And I'm going to just leave this story here as my response to that. Because this is not a denial of Ubuntu. This is not a denial of the idea that there are no others. This is an affirmation of it. This is what paves the way so that only that can live here. And sometimes when we're developing a culture, when we're working really hard in all our own different ways to create this culture in this new way, it's not always going to be pretty or cute. It's not always going to go really easily where everyone's going to get along and understand. Sometimes we're going to have to stand like Paul did. So I have another story for you. This one is from it's from the Old Testament, from the Torah, which is the Jewish scripture. This is from the book of Exodus. And this is essentially how it goes. Moses gets the Hebrews who have been slaves in Egypt out of there. He gets them out. He takes them out into the wilderness. And now they're traveling through wilderness. This is their existence. They've left behind slavery, the only home that they've ever known, hard manual labor, a rhythm that they had gotten used to. That was the only way of life they had known. And now they are wandering in the desert. And it feels aimless. And they're having a hard time finding clean water. And they're having a hard time finding food. And then they come to a spring. And they're relieved because finally there's water. But when they taste it, the water is bitter. And so in their frustration, in their exhaustion, in this complete disruption of life for them, they cry out against God and against Moses. And they demand that something be done because they will not be drinking this bitter water. And they're angry and they're accusing God of things like, he only brought us out here to die. So Moses goes to God and says, what should I do here? And the response, I think, is so significant because in different translations, it's read differently. But essentially what God replies is, if only you had trusted me to be the God who would heal you. I am the one who brought you out of slavery, but okay. So here's what you do. And he instructed Moses to take a stick and throw it in the water, and the water would become sweet. And so Moses does this. And then they drink, and it's sweet. Okay, here's the thing about this, though. Since then, more recently, they've tested the waters at Marah, which is what they have called that spring now. And Marah means bitter. And the reason why Marah is so bitter is because it has very high levels of calcium and magnesium, which would have worked as a laxative and would have completely purged every parasite and disease that they had carried out of Egypt with them. They would have gone into the new thing with no trace of the old thing left in their bodies. And not only that, just a short distance away was an oasis called Elim with palm trees and pools and fresh, clear water where they could have just gently, carefully purged and refreshed and restored themselves, and they would have been ready for the rest of the journey. Not only that, because it goes on, calcium and magnesium are the main ingredients in a drug called Dolomite, which is what endurance athletes use to endure under harsh, extreme weather and in harsh conditions. So not only would they have been purged of every parasite and disease, but then they would have been better prepared for the journey ahead. But because they were so tired and angry and they could not picture anything other than the fact that maybe God was punishing them, God had brought them out here to die, they demanded something sweet and God gave them what they asked for. And so they did not purge. They did not move forward without the old things. They were not bolstered for the journey ahead. These were decisions and choices that they made. So the thing I'm suggesting for you today is that sometimes the bitter water is for us. And if we can trust that every time there's bitter water, that in some way it's meant to heal us, then we are more equipped for what's ahead. And I think this is true. I've said this for a long time. I think that triggers are meant to heal us. When we're triggered by something, when it brings up an old wound or an old behavior or something that's been done to us, and we're in this like kind of panicky shame state, I think that the intention of that is to heal us. It's like someone plunging their hand into the bucket and all the crap that settled at the bottom of the bucket comes rising to the top. There's no clearing that out until that happens. You can't scoop those things out of there until you've been willing to plunge your hand in and let all that shit rise to the top. And I think this is true of this whole idea that right now we're in this period of time where we're trying to cultivate a new culture that genuinely is rooted in the idea that there are no others, that there's no us versus them, but we have to protect that culture. Every time somebody steps over that line in hypocrisy, anytime racism or hatred or any kind of behavior that would dehumanize someone else, anytime those things happen, like Paul, we have to stand up in the face of it publicly. We have to make sure it is heard and it's known and it's clear. This will not stand here. And friends, when bitter water comes to us, we have to somehow trust that that bitter water is meant to heal us. Because I'm willing to bet that a whole lot of you like me right now, you're triggered almost on a daily basis by things that are being said to you or about you, perceptions about who you are now. This, I hear it honestly, a few weeks ago, somebody made it very clear and said the words that they think I have lost my way, that I am struggling, that I am no longer myself. Now, my response to that, because that's something that has been said about me in the past, it's a trigger. It's a trigger that's attached to past spiritual abuse. Now, in that moment, I felt myself at a crossroads. I can react to this. I can get angry and I can demand from God sweet water. Or I can sit with that bitter water for a while and let that trigger heal me until it's clear to me that those words do not define me, that nobody else defines me, that I know what I'm doing here and I'm following the way. And friends, let me tell you, it is a narrow way. I was saying to Chidima today that I've been really thinking about this whole idea of the narrow road and how very few travel it. And I'm realizing now in this period in time in my life, because it was always defined to me in terms of rules, like you're walking the narrow way if you don't listen to secular music, and if you don't make out with boys, and if you stay a virgin till you're married, and if you don't wear short shorts, and if you don't wear a bikini, like those are the narrow way. Like those things define the narrow way. But I'm realizing now, I've shed those things, by the way, those ideas a long time ago. That shame culture is something I've been working on eradicating from my life for quite some time. But recently, I'm starting to see that the narrow way is the Jesus way. And that even people who have spent their lives going to church and reading the Bible and quoting scripture, not all of them walk this narrow road. This is a very narrow place to hug. And the way of Jesus, friends, as we have seen over and over again, is the way of compassion. It is love. It is activism. It is standing for the oppressed. It is equality. How much time did Jesus spend giving value to women? How many racial barriers did Jesus cross? How many social class barriers did Jesus cross? Over and over again, he was a thorn in the side of every religious leader of his time. And to be honest, he's a thorn in the side of a lot of religious leaders right now. And you know it and I know it. We're seeing this happen. This narrow way is becoming clearer and clearer as we head in deeper and deeper into the current political climate. And when I say political, I'm talking about what's happening in the lives of human beings. I'm talking about the policies that have been set in place to dehumanize people. And what we're seeing in the face of that is that people who follow that narrow way are standing up against it, like Paul did with Peter, even within their own communities, even to leaders who hold more authority and power and status than they do. Standing up and calling it out. Number one, for the sake of those who are being oppressed. And number two, for the sake of the community, so that Ubuntu is not threatened in this place. We have to live with non-dualism. We have to live without the idea that there is an us versus them, a me and a you. There has to be my exhale feeding your inhale and your exhale feeding mine. Inhale. We have to belong to one another. We have to do this if we want to see things change. So Mark Nepo, later on page 303 in the Book of Awakening, he writes this. He tells a question that is put to the sick by a Native American medicine man, and it's this. When was the last time you told your story? And he says, stories are like little time capsules. They carry pieces of truth and meaning over time. Whether it is a myth from 4,000 years ago or your own untold story from childhood, the meaning waits like a dry ration. Only by the next telling does it enlarge and soften to become edible. It is the sweat and tears of the telling that bring the meaning out of its sleep as if no time has passed. It is the telling that heals. It's the telling of your story that heals. And if we are sick, maybe it's because we have been holding those stories inside of us. If we are sick, maybe it's because we are not telling the truth with our lives. He says later on, if I had experienced different things, I would have different things to say. What is most healing about bearing witness to things exactly as they are, including my own part in my pain, is that when the voice of the pain fits the pain, there is no room for distortion or illusion. In this way, truth becomes a clean bandage that heals, keeping dirt out of the wound. To voice things as they are is the nearest medicine. And so, friends, I leave you with this today. Tell the truth of your story. Use your life to create Ubuntu. Drink the water when it comes to you. Know that this road is narrow, but it is worthy. That empathy and compassion are hard things to live out, but it's the worthy path. There is no other path. For anyone who loves the way of Jesus, there is no other path. There is no other way. This is the way. I want to end this just with a few moments of meditation to give you time to sit with this. So I would invite you, if you're able, if you're not driving around or cleaning your house or at work, to sit somewhere quietly for a few moments with your spine long, allowing the energy of your own body and your own spirit to move freely up and down your spine. Open your palms on your knees. Rather than gripping your hands, let them fall open and free. Close your eyes and sink into your breath. Hear the sound and feel the weight and the release of every inhale and exhale. And on your next inhale, imagine that you are being fed by the exhale of everyone on the planet. And on your next exhale, imagine that you are feeding everyone on the planet with your breath. Knowing that what you bring into you needs to be healthy and whole and clear and good and compassionate. And that what you put out into the world needs to be the same. Knowing that your breath matters, that your words matter, that your actions matter. Knowing that what you do right now in this lifetime determines whether or not you add to the culture of Ubuntu. Knowing that if you see oppression or injustice or hatred or racism or bigotry as it rises and you say nothing, you lend to the hypocrisy of the world. But if you take a chance and you stand against a force that seems bigger and broader than you, you may feel the breath of everyone who stands with you. Know that your cause is worthy, that your heart is good, and that you are not in this alone. Namaste. I would invite you, friends, into this social justice book club that Chidima and Mandy and I are all doing together. It's on Facebook. You can find it. You can actually fill out an application at my website, which is stephaniemmoores.com. And I'll add you to that group. Or if you're searching on Facebook, you can probably find it. It's hashtag Hope Rising Book Club. We would love to have you. We're about to start a new book for March. And we just got through a great book that facilitated some awesome conversation. And we would love to have you join us. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next time.